Welcome to Sustainability Decoded with Tim
and Caitlin.
On our podcast, we break down what's happening in climate, sustainability, and ESG.
And along the way, we help you get smarter about sustainability. So let's get into it.
We're excited to talk to a legend in sustainability and a leading authority on corporate purpose. Robert Eccles, or Bob as we like to call him, is today's guest. Bob was the founding chairman of the Sustainability Accounting Standards Board, or SASB, and was one of the founders of the International Integrated Reporting Council. On the show, we talked to Bob about translating activism into action and why topics that are not sexy, like accounting and corporate reporting, are critical to creating change. In this episode, Bob also plays somewhat of a co-host. Bob talks to our resident vegan, Caitlin, about how young people like her are dealing with climate anxiety and how they talk about things they don't agree on.
Never ask a guy who's an OG to do an introduction about how they got here, because that'll take up half the podcast.
Well, I'm sorry, you can cut it all.
No, it's great.
I mean, I'm too old to ask me, it's like, you know, how do I summarize the last 50 years?
I know, I think it's fantastic. You've told me before that one of the motivations for you in this space is that you're an old hippie and that you have some sort of left-leaning tendencies in your life, which is fantastic. But I just noted the synergy between kind of how maybe some of those personal motivations that brought you to this space are now being replicated in like Caitlin's generation. When mm-hmm. you see millennials really want to change the world through business, and perhaps that's a motivation you had back then, and now you have your own generation of millennials in your own family who are actually trying to live that life as well.
I mean, you know, the little joke I tell that you referred to. So, you know, I was a child of the 60s and I was an activist and I had a beard and it wasn't gray and I had a ponytail. It was fabulous.
I need pictures
for a ponytail. I wish I, you know, my wife won't let me have a man bun, so I'm depressed about that. But now I think of myself, I'm a capital market activist, right? So what are the mechanisms by which you can create change at a system level? And reporting is clearly one, and standards for reporting is clearly one. And that's kudos to GRI, because they were really the first group, you know, that was into this.
Right. So GRI, that's the Global Reporting Initiative. GRI provides the global standards for sustainability reporting. It helps organizations be transparent and take responsibility for their impact.
For me, it's been kind of like it's sort of like my life's work, but it's not how I lead my life as much. I mean, I'm not vegan, right? I mean, mm-hmm. I have a Tesla instead of a, you know, Hummer or something like that. Mm-hmm. But what I see in my children, you know, particularly in the youngest two, and then with, you know, a lot of their peers, I mean, this whole question of sustainability is really part of their life.
Yep.
And you can see why, right? I mean, if I'm lucky, maybe I'll be around in 2050. I won't be conscious enough to recognize it. Probably I'll be almost 100 or something. But,
but Bob, it's like, you know, you'll be eternal. You're immortal.
I become a vampire. It's like, it's not that far away. And I see that, and I can feel their sense of urgency. And then I look at things. So like my kind of toolkit is an institutional one, because that's where I have relationships and that's where people know me. But then I look at more grassroots things that I find interesting. I mean, like everything, they've got their issues. I'm intrigued by Extinction Rebellion.
Extinction Rebellion is an international movement for climate justice. They use nonviolent civil disobedience to demand governments to act urgently on our climate crisis.
And I've thought about, and I've never figured this out, if you could kind of mobilize sort of the millennials to understand and care about boring things like fiduciary duty and corporate reporting, and the company should have a statement of purpose and publish by the board of directors, and put pressure on the places where they work, and if their, you know, mother or father is a senior executive in the place, put pressure on them. Then you kind of have this top-down strategy, which I do, is I go and I talk to these people and say, do this and that, you know. But then if you've got the whole millennial generation, you know, kind of pushing up, you know, with a loud voice, but I don't know how to mobilize that, because the topics, mm-hmm. you know, that I deal with are pretty arcane and not zippy. But if there was ways to do that, then I think, you know, it's good.
I think in many ways, we don't necessarily have the knowledge that the older generation has about the system and how it works. So we have all this idealism right now, but we want tangible ways to know how to implement that as we move into the workforce.
But I think there's always been a challenge translating activism into action because the action gets boring. The levers of change are often things that are quite sort of meticulous, you know, and for me anyway, as an early activist, and Bob, maybe you shared this, at one point I had to grow up and get a job. And at that point I said, I'm going to get a job that serves the environment. I'm an environmentalist. I care deeply about this topic. And that created choices throughout my education, throughout my career, of finding positions that increasingly had more and more power to change things. And I continue to do that. And I think one of the things that I find really inspiring throughout the career is that eventually it became evident that you had more power to change things within companies than from outside. When I first started my career, you could either be a regulator or work in a nonprofit, that companies weren't to be trusted. But now things have changed and companies are actually doing more to protect people on the planet than governments, and they have a broader reach across the planet. That wasn't the case when I started. And where we are today, and I think what's phenomenally interesting, is that we have the entire global commerce system sort of waking up to the fact that sustainability is in fact part of financial risk and, frankly, opportunity.
I do think that there's much more consciousness about, you know, are you making the world a better, worse place? While at the same time, you may be doing good things and producing products and services. So I think that's been good, and that's fairly recent. I think that this issue around standards for reporting on performance is fundamental. It's boring, but it's fundamental. We take accounting standards for granted, but there's this baseline of kind of reality, a socially constructed reality of financial performance that we all take for granted. But you kind of more or less believe a company's financial statements because you know there's some regulation behind it and there's an auditor behind it. So getting to the point where you've got that same quality of information for what a company is doing around, you know, carbon emissions and climate change and use of water and DE&I and, you know, living wage, you know, versus minimum wage. I think having standards like that, that will have the same quality internal control and measurement systems as financial information, can be audited, you know, are trusted by the people who use it, can be integrated into the report. But I'd say of the things that I'm super excited about, and I think we've got this window of opportunity with the SEC, the International Sustainability Standards Board, and what's going on in the EU, we could lay the foundation over the next year or two for something as important as the creation of accounting standards back in the 30s.
Okay, so Bob just mentioned the International Sustainability Standards Board, also known as the ISSB. The ISSB was created out of demand from international investors. These investors wanted high-quality, reliable, and comparable reporting from companies on climate and other ESG matters. The ISSB was created by the IFRS, or the International Financial Reporting Standards Foundation. I know, so many acronyms.
So GRI, Global Reporting Initiative, I was CEO for a while, started as an activist movement. It was shaking your fist at corporations saying, what are you doing? Why are you polluting our environment? We need to know. And so it created a global standard where companies voluntarily disclose all this information. And that is now sort of commonplace. 92% of the S&P 500 release sustainability reports.
S&P 500 is short for Standard & Poor's 500. The S&P 500 tracks the performance of the 500 largest public companies in the U.S.
That's not new. We probably hit peak sustainability reporting. The new is that it's crossing over into the mainstream of global commerce, and you're seeing capital market regulations. You mentioned the Securities and Exchange Commission has a regulation that's been proposed, all sorts of movements to make this mainstream. Now, as that's happening, there's friction, right? Mm-hmm. The folks that, you know, started this movement as an activist movement are saying, wait a minute, you know, we want you to report on much more than just what is financially material, what's going to impact your bottom line.
We want to know what your total impact to the world is. And we're seeing that tension. I know you published an article where you got just a lot of the trolls and haters that were saying, you know, you've sold out, you're giving up to the man, you're going to the financial materiality side. What's your view on all that? How do you square the circle of financial materiality and caring about people on the planet?
Before Bob answers that, let's listen to him decode the term materiality.
So essentially, in a financial reporting context, materiality is information that would matter to an investor in making their decisions. And it can be financial or it could be non-financial. In the U.S., it's something called Regulation SK. But the definition of materiality is what's important to the investor from, do I want to buy this stock or not, right? Is this company going to be able to create value or not? And then there's the big question about time frame. SASB basically took the financial accounting definition of materiality. You know, do investors care about it? The GRIs was very different. You know, for them, materiality, you know, was its externalities. You know, essentially, are you making the world a better, worse place? And so then the debate is around, do we only care about information that's important to value creation, or do we care about information that may not be relevant to value creation? The company's still doing fine creating value, but it's making the world a worse place. And that's the debate that Tim is talking about.
Here, Bob shares his view on the debate around what needs to be reported by companies.
Our recommendation was peel out the, you know, Global Sustainability Standards Board, have GRI be an activist and go and push companies. Because I think it's hard to be sort of an activist and a standard setter. A standard setter has to be just this independent group. But what GRI's competencies are is to do multi-stakeholder, you know, sustainability reporting. And what the IFRS Foundation's competencies are, or FASB in the U.S., is information that matters to investors. And what is puzzling to me is why people want to turn this into like a contest. And I notice that when something like the ISSB comes out, people, like all of their hopes and dreams, they think that somehow reporting is going to be a silver bullet. We're going to have companies report on everything, whether it matters to shareholder value creation or not, and that's somehow going to change behavior. Mm-hmm. You know, reporting is not setting targets and it's not holding people accountable. It's not how compensation gets based. It's not whether the board gets it or not, what the investors are doing.
Here, Bob is schooling us on why standards should be global.
Since we recognize, and there's a lot of research that's been done, that the material ESG issues, sustainability issues, also matter to value creation, and we can come back to the double materiality, you need the same thing. So if you're an investor and it's a French chemical company or an American chemical company or Japanese chemical company, you want to have a metric. So take carbon emissions if we want to use that. I don't want to have one way that a U.S. company is reporting on its carbon emissions and another way a European company is, another way a Chinese company is. So getting that global baseline is really, really important. Otherwise, you don't have apples to apples comparisons. It's really that simple.
But if I could also jump in, what I think is happening at a macro level is that the financial markets are actually realizing that the issues of people on the planet, so-called sustainability, have become part of the financial system, that you can't ignore what's happening around you any longer because those factors impact the company.
Yep.
I mean, I can remember when I first started in corporate responsibility, let's just say it didn't have a ladder to the C-suite.
Yep.
Probably first on the layoff list. It was always considered, you know, huh, what do you do again? I mean, I wrote a whole book about this, about how to survive and thrive when you're the tree hugger in the corporate world. And I can remember going on, you know, investor road shows. I worked for a very progressive company at the time, Intel, and they would include the corporate responsibility guy, me, on these investor road shows. And I'd go into these investors and the socially responsible investors. They all wanted to hear everything I had to say. But if you ever got to an institutional investor, they'd look at you like you had a third eye in your forehead.
Yeah,
like, why are you here?
Yeah,
that's what's changed. All of a sudden, the institutional investors realize that there is, you use the words value creation. There's value in sustainability metrics. And that's why this whole alphabet soup of sustainability disclosure has become so very dynamic and so topical, and everybody's confused and trying to learn about it. But the reason is, in my view anyway, that it's crossed the threshold from activism, where it's been for decades, into mainstream global commerce. And that's what's so exciting to me, because I think of that as success. I think that
There are others who see it as selling out, kind of failure, that as this crosses over into global commerce, we're going to leave a lot of stuff out that could impact people. And how is that a good thing? So, you know, I know you've been in the center of that debate. You know, should we, it's often referred to as single versus double materiality, single being, you know, the financial aspects of sustainability, double materiality being not just financial, but impacts to people on the planet. I mean, how do you come out on that debate? Where are you on that?
So I'd say it's interesting when you look at the people that are kind of objecting to this going mainstream, like why would they object? Isn't, okay, don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. Maybe we're not taking account of everything, but we're taking account of a lot more. And a lot of these single materiality things are actually double materiality as well. So it's not like you can code them as like 0-1. I think for them, it's in their role of being kind of the challengers or the activists in their terms, they have to become more shrill, right? Because otherwise they'll say, you know, I don't want to look like to people that I sold out. So Bob sold out. So I'll scream at Bob and I can use his platform. And, but this kind of gives me sort of identity and sort of continues to establish who I am in the space of kind of professional critics. And look, it's good to have professional critics, but what is your theory of change? What is your theory of change? They don't have one.
Yeah.
They can carpet me. They can carpet the ISSB and they can feel good about themselves. It's like, okay, boys and girls, why don't you go to the streets with Extinction Rebellion? That I respect. Okay.
Yep.
That I respect. But, you know, this thing of just becoming sort of a shrill critic with no alternative theory of change, what's the point? So I'm not going to listen to it anymore. Mm-hmm. It's a waste of time.
You might, in fact, say it's a little bit sad because it took so long for us to realize that climate change was, in fact, here. It was, in fact, bad. It was, in fact, causing financial implications to companies, so much so that we have to create standards and regulate and create a whole alphabet soup around that. But my view is, because I am a lumper, that's the beginning, not the end. That finally, capital markets, investors, the world of global commerce no longer sees this as some sort of lunatic fringe activist movement, but actually sees it as important to their bottom line. Mm-hmm. And once you sort of switch that light on, you start to see other issues that perhaps activists were bringing up years ago that maybe, hey, we should look at that one too. So that's my more optimistic point of view rather than...
Look, I think, you know, first of all, to make you feel better, I mean, I can't even read the bumper stickers on cars anymore. So you know, you should at least feel good about that. I mean, look, you know, engage in the exposure drafts, critique it. Don't throw out the baby with the bathwater and say we shouldn't even have this in the first place. But then continue to be an activist is good. Like I said, standards are just, here's what the performance is. They don't set targets. They don't put pressure on companies. So I would say to the activists, you should be happy. You know, if you have standards for, you know, kind of reporting on climate and scenarios and, you know, carbon emissions, rather than, you know, getting involved in this argument where the company says, well, this is my methodology and it's better. It's like, no, standards been set. This is what it is. So go beat up on them about what they are, just like, you know, the analysts will beat up on them about their financial performance. So even for the activists, having these standards. And the thing that people don't realize, and this is again rather wonky, is like you said, look, this is just the beginning.
I know. It's truly amazing. And I go back to my lumpers and splitters comment because there are so many people sort of trying to find fault in what's happening, you know, that, the Europeans are creating a different standard set and that's going to kind of cause all this confusion. And, you know, meanwhile, you've got your friend, Emmanuel Faber, who's, you know, taking over this International Sustainability Standards Organization, saying, oh, no, we're going to talk to everybody. We're going to talk to the Global Reporting Initiative. We're going to talk to the Europeans. And by doing so, what they're fulfilling is their fundamental purpose, which is being international disclosure standards. We need one global way of measuring. And I think, Bob, you made the point that without that, we don't have comparability. And without comparability, we don't really know what we're talking about. It's the apples and oranges problem. And so I feel very optimistic about where things are and where things are going. And, you know, your article trying to support this new structure that is creating that global harmonization, drawing so much fire, is just so interesting, because there's like, there's just these camps out there that have kind of built the walls around them and they want to fight. It's a zero sum game for them because they feel like they're going to lose something in this period of change that we're in. Companies have, you know, made so many commitments and continue to make commitments, and they have to make good on those commitments. Will all of them be in their 10K? I doubt it. So we're going to continue to have this sort of two-pillar system of voluntary disclosure and mandatory disclosure. But over time, the differences between the details of how that work is done from an accounting standards point of view, from a disclosure point of view, those differences will start to become less. So I'm quite optimistic.
Can I just say one other thing on that? I mean, it's interesting. So again, people have this simplistic view of financial accounting and reporting. So we've got, you know, GAAP earnings. This is what your earnings are. How many companies report so-called non-GAAP earnings? A ton.
Lots of them.
I go, well, GAAP doesn't really apply to me because I did this transaction and this acquisition and this and that and the other thing. Maybe it's greenwashing. Maybe it's realistic. So companies have got the accounting standards. They report to the accounting standards, and they, on a voluntary basis, even with financial information, they report non-GAAP earnings. They give you sales by product line when they don't have to. They give you sales by geography when they won't have to. So there's nothing about having standards for sustainability reporting that is going to preclude companies for reporting on other aspects of their sustainability performance that they think are important that the standards don't capture. It's never going to be 100%, just like it is with financial reporting standards.
Well, as we run short on time, I'd love to kind of get your final thoughts on how you're feeling overall about the movement. Where is it going? Are you optimistic, pessimistic? Are there any things you want us to know as we go forward here?
So in December, I did a webinar with a friend of mine named Shivaram Rajgopal, who's a professor at Columbia Business School, that was sponsored by the NACD. And there's a couple women that were on boards of oil and gas companies, public and private ones. I said, you know, you haven't said anything. You know, I'd like to hear from you. They said, well, we usually don't say anything, you know, on these webinars. I said, how come? One of them said, people on the coasts don't care what we have to say. And then one of them is saying, well, you know, and there's people from California moving to Texas, and it's becoming more like California. I don't really like that. And I said, well, I live in the People's Republic of Massachusetts, so you'd probably like that even less. I have a little joke about that. So then I said, do you think we listen to each other anymore? She said, no. And that has stuck in my mind, because I live in a very, very blue state.
Mm-hmm.
And I mostly know my crowd. And I'm thinking, gee, you know, this polarization, you know, the politicization of these issues, that has to get dealt with. Mm. And how to do that, don't know. Clearly something I'm thinking about. So let me ask Caitlin this question. How many of the people you know, like, aren't in kind of, quote, our crowd? And are you able to have conversations with them or not?
Well, they obviously care about conservation of the environment, but they don't necessarily care about the urgency at which we do that, or transitioning away from fossil fuels at the rate that, you know, maybe we do. And it's interesting having conversations with them and still being able to be friends and just being able to be like, okay, let's discuss this and talk through kind of the logic of where our argument goes, how we think through this problem. And that's a good way of thinking about it, is being curious about how they think through it, rather than saying, just wiping them off as being, you know, a blanket statement of not caring or something like that.
Do you think there's more possibility that your generation, where the extremes will be less and there's more of an opportunity for a consensus, enough of consensus, or do you think that the polarization that's being, you know, kind of reproduced in some sense? I mean, each side reproduces the other, like the super woke democratic identity politics, you know, reproduces kind of the Republican cult of personality. Mm-hmm. Are you hopeful that your generation will be able to kind of break that cycle or not?
I am. I mean, I think, of course, what you hear the most of is people on the far ends of either side. They're kind of screaming the loudest. So it often blurs everything else out. But, you know, there's plenty of shades of gray in between that. And a lot of the conversations I have at the bar or just with people one-on-one, we're able to have an intellectual conversation about topics we may not 100% agree on.
What I just heard is Caitlin has most of her discussions in a bar, so.
I know.
Oh, Bob, I have one more question.
Sure.
What's one lesson your career in sustainability has taught you? It can be kind of a bumper sticker phrase, like Tim was saying as well.
One lesson? You know, it's pretty simple. It's just persist. Things that seem unimaginable or impossible can become real. And you know, and you don't control it, and you can't anticipate what the things are that will, you know, lead them to that. But just like you don't give up, keep your hand in the game, keep pushing, keep listening, look for opportunities that come along and jump on them, like when Gene came to me and was starting the Sustainability Standards Board. You know, so be open to that. And I think the other thing I'd say, and it's kind of easier for someone to do at my stage of career, is I'm not all that worried about kind of credit I get for stuff, right? People know me and this and that, but I think the more you can make introductions, create collaborations, don't try and own something for yourself, bring in other people, it's a really good thing to do.
I love that message. And Bob, when I come visit you in Boston, I want to see the bumper sticker persist on the back of your Tesla.
I'll get one. I won't be able to read it if I'm more than 10 feet away, but I'll put it on my sticker.
Persist. Put it in very large font. Wow, Caitlin, talk about an OG. Bob is incredible. Such history. What did you think?
Yeah, I think Bob is truly the godfather of ESG. He's so interesting. He has such an extensive background. I mean, it's just truly impressive with over 50 years of experience in the field. I think in some ways, like, it feels like almost a pass the torch, kind of like passing this knowledge on. And, you know, we have a lot to learn.
That was just tremendous. And I'm super excited that we've had such a good launch to our journey here on Sustainability Decoded.
Yeah, it's just exciting. Thanks so much to Bob as well for joining us.
Thank you, Bob. You've been a fantastic guest. That's it for our episode with Bob Eccles. If you want to read up on Bob's work, you can visit roberteccles.com, and the link is in our show notes.
Before we go, please don't forget to subscribe to Sustainability Decoded with Tim and Caitlin on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. While you're there, it would be great if you could rate and review the show. Thank you all for listening, and we'll catch you in our next episode.
Sustainability Decoded is produced by our incredible team at Persephone and Human Group Media. If you want to learn more about Persephone and our climate management and accounting platform, please visit our website, persephone.com.